tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary and There's a Bright Side Somewhere every morning, every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books. After the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable. All the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Rodney Shop in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Sarah Trafton is reporting for Columbia Green Media that Athens' D.R. Everett's Library is preparing for a long-anticipated $1 million project to improve accessibility for patrons. Set to start in the spring of 2021, the plan includes adding ramp access to the 113-year-old building, as well as an elevator and restroom improvements. Quote, as was typical in 1907, our library was not built to be accessible by people with mobility challenges, wheelchair users, or parents with strollers, unquote, D.R. Everett's Library Board of Trustees President Kathy Jackson said. Quote, our board has been working to raise the funds and find grant opportunities to make our library more accessible to all our Athens neighbors, unquote. The library has been saving up funds to support the renovation for 10 years, Jackson said. The project has been divided into two phases, with the ramp and restroom scheduled for the first phase and the elevator and an addition to help facilitate the ramp entrance during the second. The plans were approved by the State Historic Preservation Office, and construction for Phase 1 is expected to be complete by the end of 2022, according to a statement from the library. The timing of the Phase 2 will depend on when the funds are released, Jackson said. About 85% of the $1 million to fund the project has been raised, and the library has launched the Ramp Up the Everett's campaign to raise the remaining $150,000. As of this week, $11,000 had been raised toward the goal, according to the library's website. Read more about the story at HudsonValley360.com.
Leah Schneider is reporting for Columbia Green Media. At the Common Council's Police Committee meeting November 23rd, Hudson Police Chief L. Edward Moore reported low arrest numbers for the month of October, officers staying on 12-hour shifts, and the importance of educating the public during a pandemic. Moore said the number of arrests and incidents were below average, and no use of force was reported during the month of October. Chief of Police Commissioner Shane C. Bauer both said officers prefer the longer shifts. They work 2 days and get 2 days off, then work 3 days and get 3 days off, working 84 hours per two-week pay period. First Ward Alderperson Rebecca Wolf asked about the department's plan to enforce mass gathering restrictions over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. Moore said educating the public about the consequences of their actions is important. He said it was never intended for police officers to knock down doors and arrest people gathering on Thanksgiving. If there is a gathering that is dangerous because of the pandemic, officers will respond with attempts to educate, he said. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
Diane Valden is reporting for the Columbia paper that Ankrum residents and businesses can now make the switch to solar energy power without installing panels or the cost of installation. During the November 19th Ankrum Town Board meeting, Jill Henk, clean energy coordinator from the Capital District Regional Planning Commission, and Alex Goldfarb from a company called Solstice delivered a presentation about solarizing Ankrum. The town's Climate Smart Community Task Force and Conservation Advisory Council endorsed the idea and brought it to the board for consideration. Under the program, local households and businesses can sign up for a share of a solar farm, quote, which is like having your own panels but off your property. Your solar shares will produce energy on your behalf all year round, unquote, according to the program materials. The solar farm sends its power through the Central Hudson Power Grid to customers. The town gets credits for the power its solar shares produce, applied directly to residents and businesses' monthly utility bills, lowering the cost. Program participants will continue to receive electricity as usual. Town residents and businesses have the choice to opt in or opt out, along with a 10% savings on their electric bill every month. Every person who subscribes gets a $100 enrollment bonus. The town also receives a $100 credit per subscriber. Following the presentation, the town board unanimously approved a resolution to become a partner with Solstice Power Technologies in the community solar program. Ankrum is now the second Columbia County town to sign up. Gallatin was the first. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper.
Paul Nelson is reporting for the Times Union. 5 months since Niskayuna officials announced plans to investigate a photo posted to Facebook 2 years ago by now-retired town comptroller Paul Sebesta showing him in blackface. Local activists are calling for the findings of the investigation to be released. Days after the same issue came to light in June, Sebesta, a Democrat who also served as the head of the town's Human Resources Department, announced his retirement. Sebesta said he bought the Halloween costume he wore in 2014 during a cruise stop in the Caribbean island of St. Kitts. He said that he immediately took the post down from social media when he learned it was offensive. The members of the small activist group, members of Progressive Schenectady, brought attention to the matter. The group is now pressing Town Supervisor Yasmin Syed to make public the work done by the law firm Nixon Peabody. The group also says some town board members have downplayed the importance of the matter. Progressive Schenectady's demand comes as emails allegedly sent by Sebesta in July and December of 2009 to his wife have surfaced. One of those emails shows a racist caricature of then-President Barack Obama, and the other was an equally racist depiction of then-First Lady Michelle Obama. Syed, a Republican, told an audience at a recent town board meeting that she hoped that the law firm's report would come out soon. Lionel Egermeyer with Progressive Schenectady said the blackface controversy shows Niskayuna needs a moment of reckoning. She said, and I quote, "It is about the fact that there are people in this town who are not willing to call out his behavior, so I don't know that getting rid of Paul Sebesta solves the problem if we're not dealing with the root of it. Part of the problem is lack of transparency and not showing us that report. Why is that?" End quote. Read the full story in the Times Union.
Bill Williams is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the Edith Cayce Stocking Fund turns 100 this year. The Columbia County charity was founded during the Christmas season in 1920 by Cayce, an agent with the Columbia County Committee of State Charities, known today as the County Department of Social Services, said Ann Rubino Delaney, a longtime Stocking Fund volunteer. The Stocking Fund began when Cayce, some of her work colleagues, and community members began collecting toys for those in need. Last year, the program provided gifts to 889 children, Delaney said. The fund has expected even more requests for assistance this year due to COVID-19 and the increased number of residents without work, Delaney said. Those who wish to donate toys may bring them to the Social Services Building at 25 Railroad Avenue in Hudson, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Donation boxes will also be available at the Bank of Greene County branches in Hudson, Greenport, Germantown, and Chatham, and at Fingar Insurance in Greenport and Germantown. Recipients range in age from infant to 17 years old. Monetary donations are also accepted. Checks can be made payable to the Edith Cayce Stocking Fund at the DSS Hudson office. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Ian Conrad is reporting for the Legislative Gazette. Governor Andrew Cuomo this month signed legislation into law to protect New Yorkers' First Amendment rights from lawsuits aimed at intimidating critics, journalists, or activists. In the SLAP suit, an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, the plaintiff's intention is not necessarily to win, but instead to bog down the defendant with excessive lawyer fees and to delay the legal process. The bill signed by Cuomo allows victims of SLAP suits to be awarded legal fees if the case is found to be intended in bad faith. The bill's sponsor, State Senator Brad Holyman, said, and I quote, "With the signing of this bill, New York will have one of the strongest anti-slap suit laws in the nation, protecting New Yorkers' free speech from vindictive bullies," end quote. President Donald Trump is notorious for taking legal action against his critics using slap lawsuits. One notable example was filed 10 years ago against journalist and author Timothy O'Brien. While a reporter for the New York Times, he published a book, Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald, which included information that indicated Trump's net worth was much lower than he claimed. Trump lost the case and later said in an interview, and I quote, "I spent a couple of bucks on legal fees and they spent a whole lot more. I did it to make O'Brien's life miserable, which I'm happy about," end quote. As of 2019, there were 30 states that have anti-slap suits that make it difficult or unviable to pursue legal action in this way. And you can read the full story in the Legislative Gazette. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a partly sunny Friday with a high near 50, a low around 37, and a 20% chance of showers Friday night. It's also a 20% chance of showers Saturday morning before 10 a.m. Then it turns mostly sunny with a high of 45, and a low around 31. Sunday should also be sunny with a high of 47 and a low around 35. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, November 27th. Temperatures start out in the mid-40s this morning and will rise to 53 at 2 p.m. Nice day, dry and moderately cloudy with almost no wind. Overnight, temperatures get down to 37 degrees at dawn tomorrow. Both Saturday and Sunday are looking dry with highs in the 50s and lows in the 30s. Today's tide schedule is low at 7 a.m., high at 1:08 p.m., and low again at 7:39 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:18 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:02 a.m. Looking way up, we see that on Sunday, three near-Earth objects are expected to buzz by, the largest of which is 490 meters wide. Traveling at 25 kilometers per second, it has the equivalent of about 10,000 megatons of energy. That's enough to basically erase all of Texas. Solar wind speed is currently 423.7 kilometers per second at 5.2 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 43. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Laura Kuhn of Millbrook, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM. Listener supported radio.
We'll be right back. This is Rob around the county, and today I am talking to Jean Laporta, Claverick Town historian. She's going to talk about a bridge that's in Claverick called the Shaw Bridge. Jean, it sounds like a very interesting bridge.
Yeah, hi Rob. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for inviting me back. The bridge is very interesting. It's an historic structure, and it's located right in the hamlet in Claverick. So did you have any particular questions that you wanted?
Just about, you know, when was it built, and what kind of a bridge is it as far as the design? And
it was built in 1870 by a bridge builder by the name of John D. Hutchinson, and he used the design of a famous engineer by the name of Squire Whipple. Squire Whipple's he graduated from Union College, for one thing, in 1830, and he's famous because he designed this unique bridge structure. Before this bridge, I think they were using a lot of wood, flat wood structures, and they didn't use iron, and so he used cast and wrought iron in his design to give it the strength and also the flexibility in the in the bow structures. And he incorporated that with the wood deck design so that the bridge had strength and that it could have the wooden parts could be replaced as necessary, but without taking down the whole bridge. So in history, you know, the bridges lasted a certain length of time and they would sort of collapse from use and wear and tear and rotting away. And this one is built on a strong, his design is a strong stone foundation with those steel and, I'm sorry, with the wrought and cast iron beams and structure. So very, very strong skeletal part of that bridge. And so this is the design that Hutchinson used for Shawbridge. Shawbridge is located on what is now Van Wyck Lane. At the time in 1870 when it was built, that road was the part of the Albany Post Road. 9H was not in existence. So this little Van Wyck Lane was the main route. And it's believed, because of that, it is theorized that New York State actually contracted to build this bridge. That I can't verify, so I can't claim that for fact, but that is the theory. And so they wanted a very strong and sturdy bridge, so it's been in existence ever since then, and I remember it as a child going over the bridge, and it did have a unique feature. It was a one lane, so the traffic on either side had to stop and let the other traffic pass. And then when you went over it, it went kind of something like thumpity, thumpity, thump as you went over the wooden decking. And I always remember thinking that it didn't sound very, very safe to me. So I was hiding under the dashboard most of the time as we went over it. But anyway, learning and looking back on it now, it was such a safe and sturdy bridge. So it's still there. And the substructure is in remarkable condition. Over the years, we've had a few engineers study it. In fact, we had a very major, we've had two major studies. One was 1979. In fact, my cousin was an engineer. His name is John Testa. He doesn't live in the area any longer, but he was a student of Union College. And he had his thesis was on this bridge. Interestingly enough, I didn't realize it at the time. And we had another one done in, what year was it, by a gentleman by the name of Dr. With Ryan and Biggs Associate. Dr. Biggs did the study in 2013. So that was the more recent one. And again, even after all those years, the real strong argument for that bridge was that the substructure was very strong. It needs repair. The decking is gone at this point. It's rotted through and there's plants and stuff growing through it. But the substructure remains in amazingly good condition. So the bridge, this particular design, let me jump back to Whipple. He designed it's called a single truss bowstring bridge. So a lot of description for that basic sweeping design with the wooden deck. Van Wyck, our Shawbridge, happens to be a double span. So we actually have two arches that go over the stream, and it makes it very visually very pretty. It sits on the stream at a turn. It's pretty to look at. Let me see, what was I going to say here? So this is the only existing double span bridge of this design in its original location in the world. So it's hugely significant. And over time, you know, students and engineering enthusiasts have come to look at the bridge from all over the world, actually. A few years ago, well, there's been different times when groups of residents have gotten together and felt that they wanted to have the bridge repaired and restored. About 1980, the bridge was closed to traffic, and it was left open to foot traffic for a time and then completely closed. The date of that closure I don't have right in front of me, but it wasn't that long ago, so I think it was like in 1996 or something, that they completely, they put a barrier across it so you couldn't walk there any longer. And if you take a look at it, you wouldn't want to walk on it. It looks a little, you know, there's spaces where you can see down through the boards, and it doesn't look too good. But anyway, so a group of citizens got together and felt like they wanted to open it up to foot traffic as a walking bridge and as a historic site for visits, and you know, make it look appealing, park-like, and inviting to nature lovers and so on who would want to, you know, maybe study the bridge and just, you know, something nice to do for the town of Clarick and the people. And so there was quite a movement to do that. It boiled down to requiring quite a bit of funding to oversee the entire process of restoring that bridge. So that's where it's stalled. It's kind of sitting there in, you know, in a waiting mode while, you know, people decide how best to go about that process. And we did have the William G. Pomeroy Foundation awarded a grant for the New York State marker to be placed at the bridge entrance, so we do have a marker for it. That marker is, we had a ceremony down there. We had a commemoration of that marker in May of 2016, and quite a number, about 50 people attended, and it was quite a pleasant day. It was a beautiful, warm day, and we had the marker unveiled at the site. But the town put it in a kind of a temporary fixture there, and about 2 years later, the marker disappeared. Somebody had taken it from the site. So, you know, we posted some requests for the return of the marker, and about 3 or 4 months later, it appeared. As it left, it appeared back there. A little dinged up, a little muddy, but it was returned to the site. And so as a result of that disappearance of that marker, whether it was a joke or whatever, I don't know what they would do with the marker. For any reason, it's now in safekeeping in the town transportation department. So until they place it permanently, the reason why it's not placed permanently at this time is pending. If work is to be done on the bridge, they didn't want to have to move the marker again. So we have a beautiful blue and yellow New York State style marker. As I said, it's in safekeeping off-site, but pictures of it are available. So I have pictures of it. I have the whole write-up about this Shaw Bridge on Clarick History Minute on Facebook. So if you go onto Facebook and just, you know, go in the search bar and look for Clarick History Minute, you can type in Shaw Bridge, and that should populate right up there for you to see. You know, and it's pretty. And when you look at the bridge, I think when you see the pictures of it and the marker, the significance of it, I think it just does generate a lot of interest and maybe some enthusiasm for getting it finally repaired for people to use as a footbridge. A lot of people in the neighborhood like to walk as a form of exercise, and having the bridge just extends that ability to walk over the Clover Creek and out to the other side, and you know, I think it's a pretty walk. So I mean, that's an option. It's something to think about, whether, you know, hopefully people will consider it and, you know, put some support behind that effort. And so that's about the story of the Shaw Bridge. I think I covered about all the real pertinent details. Rob, did you have any particular interests?
I was wondering, you said the bridge is on your Facebook site. Maybe you could give my listeners the name of the official name for that Facebook page.
Okay, sure. It's Facebook, of course. You'll log on to Facebook as you normally would if you have an account there, and you'll put in the search bar Clarick History Minute, and that brings you to the Clarick History Minute page. I developed that Clarick History Minute page when I first became the historian in the town as a means of using, you know, kind of a popular social media to get little bits and jots of history out there to the public, and hopefully, and in some to some extent, this has happened, that there would be some, you know, dialogue and a sharing of ideas and memories about the town. I wrote the story up when we did the commemoration in 2016 for the historic marker at the site, and I placed pictures of that marker and the bridge and some of the ceremony, and wrote up a little history of the bridge for that site, so that it kind of fleshes out what I've talked about here this morning.
Have you been in touch with the Columbia County Historical Society as far as have you ever submitted anything? Have they ever done any article in their magazine?
Whether they have, you know, I am sure they must have in the past, but I haven't particularly seen anything. You mean in their History and Heritage magazine?
Yes. Maybe you could make a query to it, because it'll be interesting, and then we could find out, and that could be another source. If an article was written on it, the people could look for it too.
Correct, and yeah, that's a really good idea. I could let you know that at another time. If the announcement of that, I definitely will find that out, and yeah, definitely. And if not, that's a good idea for the future. I could maybe suggest that we do that. So I'm almost certain that they must have over the years, because this discussion about, you know, renovating and repairing the bridge, at one point they actually did want to reopen it to traffic, and they had a big meeting down there with the then Clovick Historic Society was actively pursuing that angle. They had a petition going around at the time. Some of the neighbors in the immediate vicinity did not want it opened. And the reason being, people would use this neighborhood as a crossroads between 9H and 23, avoiding the 23-9H traffic light. And the traffic sometimes that you might encounter there with the post office and at the time the store. So the traffic would zip through here, but they went very fast. So we had, you know, children in the neighborhood, and there was some safety concern. So rightfully, people did say, you know, they had some questions about opening that to vehicular traffic again. And I think that in more recent years, since 2016, when we did the sign commemoration, and actively our historic advisory committee was actively supporting the notion of opening it, but opening it only for foot traffic. The goal really to maintain the bridge, to keep it in good repair, so that it's a historic artifact that we can study and not allow it to crumble into disuse and abandon. So in the summertime now, when you go by, you'll see a lot of trees and bushes. And honestly, the town does go in and clean it up. You know, they'll mow it and cut some of that stuff down so that it doesn't completely take over. But it is more and more becoming engulfed in all the brush and stuff like that. So it's less and less visible, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So and that's a shame, because it's quite a feat and quite a gift to our town. Some of these bridges, there is one that was relocated to the Union College campus, mm-hmm. and that one was, of course, fully restored and put on the campus as a, you know, engineering study. And then I can't tell you how many of the Whipple design bridges were used for the Erie Canal. I think the number may be in the hundreds. Of those, maybe a few of them have survived. There's a few that have been moved. But not in their original location. So there is one of the Whipple design bowstring truss bridges located in a city in Japan. And I think that's called the Hachiman Bridge or something similar to that. So it does reach some international interest for that reason. and it's quite a pretty design. It's sweeping and arched and simple. So it's got a nice quality to it. And yeah, as I said, engineering students love to look at it. And did I say that it was the first scientifically based bridge? So it actually had, a mathematical calculation of load bearing, the notion that, the distance and strength supported the weight that was on it. I had read an interesting article about a bridge that was built in Stockport, and they said that the load test was that they drove a wagon loaded with a heavy cargo over the bridge, and that since the bridge was able to withstand that very heavy load, they knew that it was good for the rest of the traffic. That was quite a test. Maybe that's what they did, but it struck me as a very funny way to do a load test after you spent all that time and effort to build the bridge, and then, not knowing whether it would support it or not, it could fall down in the process. So this bridge was calculated, by its distance and weight and strength to hold. So the first of its kind in many respects.
At the least, I think, if they could cut more of those brush, at least make it visible. I think if it was seen, more interest would be of it. People would notice it.
Correct. It's tucked back in the neighborhood, now tucked back. At the time it was built, as I said, this was the primary route. So people pass through here. This was a public conveyance here. But nowadays it's tucked into the back of the little neighborhood, and I think people view it as more of a private location.
Mm.
But it actually isn't. It is actually a very public part of the town. I think it's interesting, and I really have been a strong advocate of repairing the bridge. I hate to see it, sit wasting when, at the least, we should try to keep it.
I was wondering, for money for it, of course, it would be great if some organization, they received a grant for it, for some of the expense of repair.
Right. I that's one option to do it.
Speaking to Union College, maybe there are people there that are still interested in it, or maybe they need to be made aware of it, this bridge that's so close. And since it's been a few years since, maybe in the past it was a union student researching it, if there's an interest again.
Right, to revive that interest. I know that Dr. Triggs, who did the study, was affiliated with Union. Whether he was a graduate or not, I have his paper here. I can take a quick look if I can find it. I may not be able to find his information as quickly. But I think Union College has been made aware of this, and they've been down since to take a look. I think there's a limit as to what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
As far as being supporting, yes, but there's a limit because it has to come from the towns and the county even. I believe, I could have this wrong, the town was in charge of maintaining the roadbed, which means the decking, and the county was in charge of maintaining the structure. The way they worked that out, that has to do with the transportation and the way they divide up that part of it. But I believe that's how that system worked. Until now, the bridge was declared closed. And so it was, I don't want to use the word abandoned, but it was just sort of discontinued by the county. So they no longer come in and do they don't have to inspect it or anything because there's no traffic. It's been officially closed. And the town maintains somewhat in keeping the grass and the brush cut down around it. I don't know if it's actually safe to walk on the decking anymore to clean from the people. It's an important structure, and And this radio program will be a good way of teaching about that and why they should be interested in it. It has ties to really an interesting engineering feat and significant engineering feat. Both Hutchinson and Whipple were very renowned in their field. Hutchinson was responsible for hundreds of bridges in his career, and Whipple won the patent for the design in 1840, I believe. I think it was 1840. He actually has a patent number. It took him some time to get recognition for the patent, but he did get it. And so it's important. And the fact that it's the only one still standing in its original location, I think that that, you know, is hugely important. So, yeah, why not protect it? So anything that you think your listeners might be interested in, surely.
Okay, well, Gene, it's Gene LaPorta and the town historian of Clavrec who talked about the Shaw Bridge. Thank you again, Gene.
Oh, you're very welcome, Rob. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Brian from Olathe, Kansas, and you're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
Find out where the music takes Snarky Puppy and the Metropole Orchestra on the next Deep Threes as they join forces to perform music about the forest. Plus the sounds of Crystal Palace, Errol Fjord, Zero Cult, Hodge, and the Righteous Girls. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518- 622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Michael Shemitis of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, November the 27th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. More than 50 advocacy organizations have sent a letter to Pennsylvania's congressional delegation urging immediate action on a new COVID relief package.
10 months into the COVID pandemic, more than 1.3 million Pennsylvania households report they are struggling to put food on the table, and 500,000 households have fallen behind in their rent. But according to Jeff Garris with the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, many provisions of relief packages passed early this year, such as extended unemployment assistance and the moratorium on eviction, will expire if Congress doesn't act when they return from the Thanksgiving recess.
We need to know that when people get to the holidays, they're not going to find themselves cut off from the vital aid that they need. So we are calling on our members of Congress and our senators, don't be the Grinch this year.
The House passed the HEROES Act, an expanded relief bill, in May, but so far the Senate has failed to pass a supplemental relief bill. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
A recent report from the Century Foundation found that without congressional action, 12 million people nationwide will lose federal health benefits December the 26th. Meantime, our Diane Bernard reports while high pollution often is found in black and brown communities, a new poll shows that many white Americans are not aware of the gap.
In Virginia, the majority-minority area of Charles City County already is home to a landfill with plans to build two frack gas-fired power plants. Faith Harris with Virginia Interfaith Power and Light says many white Virginians don't know about the environmental struggles in the county because of segregation and lack of education. She says the power plants pose a perfect storm of pollution for a historically African-American community.
This community is way overburdened with these air quality issues as well as possible water quality issues because of the pollution that would come from all of this concentrated industry.
The national poll conducted by the Environmental Defense Fund shows that 60% of black respondents say they're very concerned about air pollution in their communities versus 32% of white respondents. I'm Diane Bernard.
About 70% of black and Latino respondents say climate change is a major problem compared with 51% of white people. A 14-point difference. The Guardian reports that President Donald Trump said he will leave the White House when the Electoral College votes for Democratic President-elect Joe Biden, the closest the outgoing president has come to conceding defeat. The Guardian notes that Biden won the presidential election with 306 Electoral College votes, many more than the 270 required to Trump's 232. Biden also leads Trump by more than 6 million in the popular vote tally. This is PNS. 2020 was a tough year in pushing voter turnout among North Dakota Native Americans because of the pandemic. The state didn't see as much activity in tribal areas as in other parts of the country. One group says the connections still were being made and has its eyes on future elections.
Going into 2020, North Dakota Native Vote wanted to build on the higher turnout among Native populations the state saw in 2018. But early estimates indicate the number will be lower. However, the group's Nicole Donaghy says because of the adaptability of their field staff, their momentum isn't lost forever.
We've made those connections and we were reinforcing our brand, getting, you know, North Dakota Native Vote out there again. And so people are certainly familiar with us and that can only help.
Amid the election's final stages, COVID cases were spiking in North Dakota. The group did virtual training for canvassers on reservations to still reach voters. Donaghy says looking forward, they'll do more planning so they can deploy a variety of strategies based on the circumstances. The energy from Native voters in recent years is seen as important because of the state's voter ID requirements, which advocates say disenfranchises their people. I'm Mike Moen.
COVID-19 has caused a big spike in poverty, and now California has the country's highest number of kids experiencing hunger, with 2.2 million living in food insecure households, where at least one family member does not have enough to eat.
Tamara Sandberg with the nonprofit Save the Children says the organization has partnered with rural school districts to distribute meals.
California has seen the highest increase in the number of children living in food insecure households, with over 860,000 more California kids experiencing hunger now compared with before the pandemic.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Next Tuesday is Giving Tuesday. People who want to help can text the word PLATE to 20222 to make a one-time $10 donation. Finally, our Nadia Ramlagan lets us know college students at Northern Kentucky University are participating in a program that allows them to give away thousands of dollars in grants to local nonprofits.
Researchers found that among 500 students who took the philanthropy class when they were sophomores, 58% went on to graduate versus 24% overall. Kaisa Larson is an associate professor of Spanish and faculty coordinator for Mayerson Student Philanthropy Project classes at NKU. She says community engagement makes the topics studied in the classroom real and relevant.
The incorporation of student philanthropy in a class makes students more engaged. We've not only seen that in our own students and our own classrooms, but the data also reflects that.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, heard on great radio stations across the nation, and always online at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Sarah Tapton and Natasha Vaughn are reporting for Columbia Green Media. Columbia County Sheriff David Bartlett and Greene County Sheriff Pete Kaminsky have added their names to the list of New York sheriffs to declare their departments will not enforce Governor Andrew Cuomo's 10-person limit on private gatherings. The restriction went into effect November 13th, along with regulations for gyms and establishments licensed by the state liquor authority to close by 10 p.m. Kaminsky said in a statement, and I quote, "The Greene County Sheriff's Office is not going to be actively enforcing executive orders regarding gatherings in people's homes. We do not have the resources or inclination to peep into everyone's home to see how many people are at the dinner table," end quote. Kaminsky said entering a private residence would require a search warrant. He said enforcement raises several constitutional questions. "The sheriff's office is not encouraging residents to have large gatherings," Kaminsky added. Bartlett said his office will not be enforcing the mandate either. Bartlett said in a statement, and I quote, "Columbia County Sheriff's Office will not be participating in the enforcement of New York State's Thanksgiving gathering restrictions. We hope that everyone will be mindful of the current health pandemic as we enter the holiday season. Enjoy this time with your families," end quote. New York Sheriff's Association has taken a similar stance on the new restrictions. Association Deputy Executive Director Charles J. Gallo, in a statement, said, and I quote, "We do not know if the governor's limit on home gatherings to 10 individuals is the right number or not. That is a decision for science, not us, to make." Read more at HudsonValley360.com. Rachel Silverstein is reporting for the Times Union. The Niskayuna Board of Education has banned the Confederate flag in district schools. The board last week approved prohibitions on displays of Confederate flags and other hate symbols as part of a new policy designed to address opportunity gaps and increase anti-racist programming in school. The policy was first proposed in July in response to a letter signed by nearly 75 Niskayuna teachers and staff who called on the board to ban Confederate symbols from school grounds. They argued the images were disruptive to the learning environment. Niskayuna Board President Howard Schlossberg said November 23rd, and I quote, "I don't think there was a single event. It has been brewing over time. The students and faculty have been talking, and I think it just reached a critical mass, and they said it's time to put this out and start talking about this," end quote. Board members unanimously approved the policy, which commits the district to anti-racist programs and training, correcting practices that perpetuate opportunity gaps, and encourages, and I quote, "every decision-making group in the district to recommend additional anti-racist practices within the school district to the board policy committee," end quote. The district will implement anti-racist programs for students at all levels, provide opportunities for bias awareness and anti-racist training district-wide, identify and address barriers that prevent the district from increasing diversity in employment and programs, and review curriculum, instructional materials, and resources to ensure the inclusion of racially and culturally relevant content. Read the full story in the Times Union. William J. Kimball is reporting for the Daily Freeman. The Ulster County Industrial Development Agency is considering a proposal to change fees for documents requested under the State Freedom of Information Law. Agency Chief Executive Officer Rose Woodworth said recent request for nearly 3,000 documents at a time about the proposed mixed-use development known as the Kingstonian have been costly and time-consuming. Woodward said processing the request cost the agency thousands of dollars. And I quote, "and that's not fair," end quote. She said fulfilling the request cost the agency about $1,000 in legal time. Under the proposed policy change, requests of up to 10 pages would remain free of charge. Requests that result in more than 10 pages would cost 25 cents per page and up to $100 per hour for preparing the copies. The hourly rate would be reduced if the work is done by agency staff or attorneys. Woodward said the work is not done by agency employees. It is done through the agency law firm, which impacts the cost. Research requests and production of records in digital form would still be done at no charge. However, more complex searches for digital materials would trigger exemptions that require a fee. The agency board is expected to vote on the new policy next month, and you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. The local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXE.org. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, November 27th. Temperatures start out in the mid-40s this morning and will rise to 53 at 2 p.m. Nice day, dry and moderately cloudy with almost no wind. Overnight, temperatures get down to 37 degrees at dawn tomorrow. Both Saturday and Sunday are looking dry with highs in the 50s and lows in the 30s. Today's tide schedule is low at 7 a.m., high at 1:08 p.m., and low again at 7:39 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:18 p.m., and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:02 a.m. Looking way up, we see that on Sunday, three near-Earth objects are expected to buzz by, the largest of which is 490 meters wide. Traveling at 25 kilometers per second, it has the equivalent of about 10,000 megatons of energy. That's enough to basically erase all of Texas. Solar wind speed is currently 423.7 kilometers per second at 5.2 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 43. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
Like a fire hydrant. Like a public drinking fountain. Like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
I'm sitting here wondering if this matchbox will hold my dreams. The redhead in my arms go up in flames, or dissolve mighty regimes with her screams. Or so it seems. She dragged my face from the eye to my lip on the rough side of the striking strip, to the port side of a sinking ship, staring at a compact mirror, the siren calling from another era. While you made faces and then blew kisses, drowned in a pool that hypnotized Narcissus. They say I have a perfect face for radio, and a trumpet for listening, a cheek to turn to you, an eye for glistening. Tear that tear from me, hold it in your memory. Pull away the powder and the pain-painted dream of this and that disgrace. A silver band of marching souls, a button of brass, an epaulet of gold. That Lenten light, that slight fanfare that consoles. That trivial, sniveling rosary, that ring-a-ding rosemary. Condemned a man, alas. At last, at Requiem Mass. sound much better than I look. Like a hero in a book. Now there is too much at stake, but perhaps you mistook my mistake for the tip in the print you dusted for from the hand you forgot to shake. Tumbledown Dick said to King Oliver, I don't shrink down at the thought of you. Give the people back their ringlet prince, just like you ought to do. Journey far from here like Gulliver, to lands at the edge of everywhere that we have still to discover. Where there's a soul of a jackboot in a broken brace, poised above a human face, forever and ever. Just doesn't matter if I should deceive you or if I should flatter. If your bankroll gets thin while some kitty gets fatter, radio is everything. From the straight to the narrow, to the broadcast from within, radio is everything. Radio is everything.
It was back last October, I believe it was. We was going to hold a tent service all off at this college town. And we got there about dinner time on Saturday. And different ones of us thought that we ought to get us a mouthful to eat before that we set up the tent. And so we got off of the truck and followed this little bunch of people through this small little bitty patch of woods there. And we come up on a big sign. It says, get something to eat here. And I went up and got me two hot dogs and a big orange drink. And before that I could take every mouthful of that food, this whole raft of people come up around me and got me to where I couldn't eat nothing, up like, and I dropped my big orange drink. I did. Well, friends, they commenced to move, and they want so much that I could do but move with them. Well, we commenced to go through all kinds of doors and gates and I don't know what all, and I looked up over one of them, and it says North Gate. And we kept on going through there, and pretty soon we come up on a young boy. And he says, ticket, please. And I says, friend, I don't have a ticket. I don't even know where it is that I'm going. I did. Well, he says, come out as quick as you can. And I says, I'll do her. I'll turn right around the first chance I get. Well, we kept on moving through there, and pretty soon everybody got where it was that they was a-going. Because they parted and I could see pretty good. I could. And what I seen was this whole raft of people a-setting on these two banks and a-looking at one another across this pretty little green cow pasture. Well, they was. And somebody had tucked and drove white lines all over it and drove posties in it and I don't know what all. And I looked down there and I seen five or six convicts a-running up and down and a-blowing whistles. They was. And then I looked down there and I seen these pretty girls a-wearing these little bitty short dresses and a-dancing around. And so I sat down and thought I'd see what it was that was going to happen. I did. And about the time I got set down good, I looked down there and I seen 30 or 40 men come running out of one end of a great big outhouse down there. They did. And everybody where I was a-sitting got up and hollered. And about that time, 30 or 40 come running out of the other end of that outhouse, and the other bank pulled, they got up and hollered. And I asked this fellow that was besetting beside of me, I says, friend, what is it that they're hollering for? Well, he whopped me on the back, and he says, buddy, have a drink. Well, I says, I believe I will have another big orange. And I got it and sat back down. And when I got down there again, I seen that them men had got in two little bitty bunches down there. They had rail close together. And they voted. They did. They voted and elected one man apiece. And them two men come out in the middle of that cow pasture and shook hands like they hadn't seen one another in a long time. And then a convict come over to where they was a-standing, and he took out a quarter, and they commenced to odd man right there. They did. Well, after a while, I seen what it was that there's odd man in for. It was that both bunches full of them men wanted this funny-looking little pumpkin to play with. They did, and I know, friends, that they couldn't eat it because they kicked it the whole evening and it never busted. But anyhow, what I was telling was that both bunches full wanted that thing, and one bunch got it, and it made the other bunch just as mad as they could be, and friends, I seen that evening the awfulest fight that I have ever seen in my life. I did. They would run at one another and kick one another and throw one another down and stomp on one another and grind their feet in one another and I don't know what all, and just as fast as one of them would get hurt, they'd tote him off and run another number. Well, they'd done that as long as I sat there. But pretty soon, this boy that had said, ticket, please, he come up to me and he says, friends, you're going to have to leave because it is that you don't have a ticket. And I says, well, all right. And I got up and left. And I don't know, friends, to this day what it was that there's a-doing down there, but I have studied about it. And I think that it's some kindly of a contest where they see which bunchful of them men can take that pumpkin and run from one end of that cow pasture to the other without either getting knocked down or stepping in something.
The melody that's haunting me won't disappear. You are that sweet song that I long to hear. You're my relation, my favorite station. I'll never change. You are so near, so loud and clear. You are my radio.
Have I been here long for your sweet song harmony? With you, my sweet song is where I long to be. You're at the top of, never drop off of my hit parade. You are so near, so loud and clear. You are my radio.
You are my radio.
There's a story you once told, and it had to do with World War II.
And I know the one about the dentist.
Yes, this thing is stranger than fiction.
Well, it's true. To make it short, I had some dental work to be done. You know, they put in temporary fillings.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never had it done before. What is it, lead?
I think in those days they were putting in temporary lead fillings.
Yeah. It was quite a while ago.
During the war?
Yeah. And
World War II.
Yes. And I had several, upper and lower. And I went to work that day, and I got home very late. And it was, I don't remember what year, but it was after they had taken the Japanese out of California and unfortunately put them in the camps, which was a very sad time in California. And we were all on our guard, you know, about many things. There had been a Japanese submarine sighted in Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. and a Japanese fighter plane had been sighted going over our home one evening. It was touchy times. Anyway, this particular night was about 1:15, and I was driving alone. I had 35 miles to drive, and it wasn't any fun. It was just a normal night. I wasn't frightened or anything. I was just driving along. And a road that I'd taken many times. And all of a sudden, I heard music. But I mean, with a great beat, you know. And I looked down to turn off my radio, and it wasn't on. And I turned around and looked to see if there's anyone behind me. And the music was getting louder and louder and louder, and I realized it was in my mouth. And it was beating in my ears. Yeah.